This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Right, let's take all that atomic poison away. Well, we're now in the post Cold War era, an interregnum marked by major geopolitical changes, uncertainty, and an unrestrained nuclear arms race. To talk with us about an international conference to learn from a remarkable group of analysts and movement leaders from partner organizations across the U.S. and Europe and East Asia to deepen our understanding of the changing world and how we can best respond is Joseph Gerson. Joseph is the American Friends Service Committee Disarmament Coordinator. He's a director of programs in New England and is director of the Peace and Economic Security Program. He's played a leading role in building collaborations among the U.S., Asian, and European peace and nuclear weapons abolition movements. And his program work focuses on challenging and overcoming U.S. global hegemony, including its preparations for and threats to initiate nuclear war and its military domination of the Asia, Pacific, and the Middle East. He's also author of the renowned, wonderful, you must read, Empire and the Bomb, and it is quite the pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Mimi. That was quite an introduction.
Well, you're quite the person to introduce. And I want to begin by your assessment, really, at this juncture with the advent of the Trump administration and the plutocracy that occupies the seat of power now. Where do we stand with that kind of nuclear clock that was ticking closer and closer and closer to midnight? How do we define the most prominent issues and the level of threat?
Well, I think maybe the place we've got to begin is the fact that the United States is no longer considered a classical democracy. It's termed a flawed democracy, and I think that's a generous analysis. So, you know, at one level, and most basically, is the struggle here in the United States to restore some semblance of democracy, to preserve justice, and really to prevent, you know, fascism from taking over. In that context, we have the reality of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, who do their doomsday clock to serve as a warning to the world in terms of where we might stand in terms of the dangers of nuclear war. And last year, and then again this year, they set that clock at 2 minutes to midnight, midnight meaning nuclear or now environmental apocalypse. This is the closest it's been since 1953, and when it was at the same time. So the dangers are enormous. We now, spurred by the U.S. withdrawal from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which I know sounds pretty wonky to people, but with Trump's withdrawal from that, the commitment by the United States to spend something like $1.7 trillion for a new generation of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, we're entering into a period of really an unrestrained nuclear arms race with Russia, to a lesser degree with China. And in addition to the possibility of some madman, we may have one in Washington, hitting the nuclear button, there's also the very real danger of nuclear weapons accidents or miscalculations during crises. So the situation is very, very severe, and again complicated, you know, by the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty, and plans now to put medium and short range missiles into Europe, which brings us back to a situation similar to late 70s, early 80s, you know, when the fears were so great that it sparked really a global movement.
So you really see as terribly significant the withdrawal of Trump, who was first to pull a plug on the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And where does this fit in with the U.S. now, Russia and China, all on the brink of a dangerous and unrestrained nuclear arms race? And Al, give us that analysis. So the treaty was, I dare say, in your view, major significance, and as it interacts with and promotes this unrestrained war, certainly ideological war around nuclear arms with Russia and China. So is that what also pushes us even closer to that midnight hour?
Yeah. So again, just going back to a little bit of history, you know, you had a combination of mass movements in Europe, the freeze movement here in the United States, the Common Security Commission led by Olof Palme in Sweden, and Gorbachev in the Soviet Union's understanding that he had to move to reduce spending and the danger of nuclear weapons. So all that came together ultimately in 1987 with the negotiation of the INF Treaty. We were in a situation where the U.S. was about to deploy short-range missiles that could not only hit Eastern Europe, but could basically wipe out the Soviet leadership within 8 minutes. And the negotiation of this treaty, and the Russians were also about to deploy weapons as well, the negotiation of this treaty in 1987 essentially ended the Cold War 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So this was seminal. And with Trump and Bolton removing that treaty now, you know, it moves us back toward the confrontation with Russia. This is further complicated, and I know, you know, most people are not paying too much attention to foreign and military policy these days, and that's understandable. But the reality is that beginning with Bill Clinton, the United States violated a fundamental agreement made with initially the Soviet Union and then obviously with Russia, that Germany could reunify on West German terms in exchange for a commitment that the United States wouldn't move NATO a centimeter closer to Moscow. And with the Clinton administration, that movement east began to the point now where you have U.S. and NATO troops all along Russia's borders. You know, think what the United States might think about here if there were Russian or Chinese forces in Mexico or in Canada. And, you know, the Russians have a history, their, you know, historical memory, their frame of reference is Napoleon's disastrous invasion, World War I, and then World War II, all invasions coming from the West. So this has really heightened the crisis. And we have very intense and provocative military exercises by both the United States and the Russians in the Baltic and the Black Sea, along their borders, and you know the danger is that in an incident, for example, a young naval officer who with his fingers on anti-aircraft missiles deciding to shoot one off when a Russian plane buzzes it at 100 feet above their ship, or you know vice versa. So it's a situation which could spin out of control, and we have to really kind of come back from the brink. In relationship to China, and this kind of relates more to the fundamental changes in the global order, you know, we're now in a situation where you know, the United States has long been the dominant power and empire across the Pacific and much of Asia. And China now, more than 30 years into its reform and opening, kind of the rise of China, you know, they're pushing back against U.S. domination. We see this militarily, we see it economically, in a whole range of areas. And so technologically, just listen to the discussions about 5G technology. So we're in really a classical crisis of the tensions between a rising and declining power. And you know, we need to be finding, again, a common security approach to help ensure that incidents don't lead to to disaster.
And Joseph, the major powers now, like India, and the nuclear ambitions of country like Saudi Arabia, for example, obviously pose new challenges.
This is again a fundamental change, where you have look, nuclear weapons technology is what, 75 years old. So countries like Saudi Arabia, in relationship to, in its effort to kind of remain the dominant power or a dominant power in the Middle East, is not only moving toward nuclear capacity, but really, tragically, has the support of the Trump administration in moving toward proliferation. India and Pakistan are locked in a nuclear arms race. And one of the things we're bringing Aichin Vinaik from India, one of the co-founders of the Indian Peace and Nuclear Disarmament Movement, to our conference. I want people to understand that physicians for social responsibility, leading climate scientists, did a study in which they found that even a small nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, maybe 50 to 100 nuclear weapons, in addition to killing millions of people immediately there in South Asia, the fires would be so intense and create so much smoke that you would have what's called global cooling, resulting in famine across the northern hemisphere and killing up to 2 billion people, which is to say that the nuclear arms race in South Asia can have direct impacts on us here in the United States and across the north. So one of the goals, for me, in this conference is to kind of help build some solidarity between our movements so we can help one another moving forward.
And I also want to ask you to bring into the equation the issues of South Korea, for example. How do you look at that? And certainly, the Japanese as well, to give us a kind of picture of some of the issues that will be discussed and some of the participants and some of the outreach that have been engaged in this desperate an imperative struggle to curtail and really eliminate what is now really an unrestrained nuclear arms race.
Yeah, so I count myself as very lucky. We're able to bring Lee Tae-ho from Seoul. He's been the leading figure in South Korea's leading NGO, People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy, and played a major role in the Candlelight Revolution that overthrew the last quasi-dictator. And we have not only a leader of the Japanese Peace and Disarmament Movement, but also the Secretary General of the Organization of Atomic and Hydrogen Bomb Survivors. So we're going to be able to bring this into the room very, very well. With Korea, we have the situation in which Trump, as he often does, so totally overreacts and attempted to bully everybody with his fire and fury rhetoric and military preparations. And as we all know, this brought us to the brink of what would have been a catastrophic war. We're able to pull back from the brink, not because of Trump's genius or lack thereof, but because of the brilliant diplomacy of South Korea's President Moon. So now, as we know from the failure of the U.S. North Korean summit in Hanoi, which the United States again overstepped, and with Bolton and Pompeo just made demands that could not be met. What we're going to hear, I expect, from Lee Tae-ho is going to be, look, we need to keep this diplomacy going. The United States, we need support from popular movements in the United States to press U.S. policy to be seeking incremental changes that can move toward trust building between the United States and North Korea so you can move toward more fundamental agreements. I mean, the United States destroyed in the Korean War about 90% of everything that stood in North Korea. We've prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear attack against them at least 9 times. So, you know, they have reason to be scared, which is not to say they're a particularly good government. So I think what we'll be hearing there is calling for the United States to say that the Korean War is finally over, to begin negotiations to replace the armistice agreement with a peace system, as they call it, and also to at least remove some of the sanctions so that you can have a deepened South Korean, North Korean economic cultural collaboration to kind of move toward a more peaceful system. The danger, of course, here is that with the collapse of the diplomacy and with an election coming, we could be moving back to the brink, and we need to prevent that. With our Japanese partners, they in Japan and Britain are the two countries where nuclear disarmament movement is very much a social movement. I mean, they have on the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are world conferences against NH bombs that bring together more than 20,000 people. And, you know, the annual official ceremonies, you know, bring together probably about 50,000 people, maybe, you know, about 70,000 people. So it's very deep in the culture. They'll be coming with concerns about the accelerated nuclear arms race. I think they'll be urging us to remember that next year, 2020, marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombings, and urging us to kind of move to raise this in our understanding and our organizing.
Joseph,
that
let
this
me
will be one of the last
let
times
me also since you mentioned that the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki A-bombings will occur in 2020. Talk a bit about, I know you're really at the conference is being held at the midway point of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty PREPCOM at the United Nations. Talk about that and some of the strategies that are developing to influence the outcome of the PREPCOM that is going to be held at the United Nations.
Sure. So, I mean, first of all, people need to understand what the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is. It was maybe one of the three most important treaties of the 20th century, a fundamental deal in which the non-nuclear weapon states committed to remain non-nuclear, not to have nuclear weapons, and in exchange, the nuclear weapon states on the one hand, made the mistake of saying that the other countries had the right to generate nuclear power for peaceful purposes, but also they committed in Article 6 to engage in good faith negotiations for the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals. Frankly, the rest of the world is at the way that the United States and the other nuclear powers have resisted implementing this commitment, which is now more than a 40-year-old commitment. With the review conferences, and there'll be a review conference in 2020, this is a chance for the governments of the world to try to hold one another accountable, including in reference to Article 6. The PREPCOM is sort of a preparation for that. In the middle now of a accelerated nuclear arms race and increased dangers, the expectations for the outcomes of those, the PREPCOM and the review conferences are not high. But we need to understand that the rest of the world is not only angry, they've been doing something about it. And so, 2 years ago at the UN, 122 countries promulgated a treaty called the Nuclear Prohibition Treaty, Nuclear Weapons Prohibition Treaty, which reaffirms, their commitments to the NPT, and is designed to put more pressure on the nuclear weapons states. So I think what we'll see at the PREPCOM, and certainly in 2020, certainly the Japanese will be pushing it, many of the Europeans, that we need to move toward full implementation, more universal signing and ratification of the treaty. It goes into effect when 50 countries have signed it, and pressure for the United States and other nuclear powers to begin moving towards serious consideration and maybe signing the treaty. We look, I mean, one of the things that we look at in terms of how things work politically in Britain, you know, with their struggle over Brexit, there's a chance that Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party will come to power in a coming election. If so, he's pledged to sign the ban treaty. That's to say, a nuclear weapons state would sign the treaty. It would be a major, major change. Similarly, in Australia, I mean, where I say that a lot of the rubber hits the road is in the so-called umbrella states, the countries that are in some ways, their military policy is dependent on U.S. Nuclear weapons threats. And again, there, the Labour Party is on the verge of taking power. If it does, a majority of their members of parliament have said they'll back the ban. So you do have some openings and some cracks in the system that could help us to build back.
And lastly, one of the things that we've really got to talk about is that at this nuclear disarmament conference, you've specifically invited speakers from the movement for Black Lives Matters and U.S. labor against the war. The synthesis that is in imperative to break through our kind of being siloed or the bifurcation between anti-war movements and anti-nuclear proliferation movements and so on, the imperative for these movements to come together and the understanding that this is a working session conference to really progress in a more holistic and comprehensive way to surge ahead to stop the proliferation of the nuclear arms race.
Yeah, I mean, we have an understanding that the issues are connected. They don't exist separate from one another. Among other things, if you're going to spend $1.7 trillion for nuclear weapons, what does that mean in terms of funding for housing? What does that mean in terms of the cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency? What does that mean in terms of you know, kind of reinforcing the structures of racism that we have? The causes are connected, and you know, siloed movements rarely prevail. It's certainly the case for peace and nuclear disarmament movements. So we understand not only do we want to bring you know, the struggles for justice into our movement, we want peace activists to understand that they need to be part of the struggles against racism for economic and social justice and for the environment here in the United States. So we're hoping that with Reverend Griffith Sekou and with Reese Chenault, that they'll move people. And I think others, you know, some of the white speakers as well, will be talking about how essential it is that we move toward more integrated organizing.
And I should say that some of the sessions that you will be able to hear, and there'll be a keynote by the wonders of the virtual airwaves, the video by the magnificent, the most important whistleblower of the last century, who continues to be active every step of the way, Daniel Ellsberg, on the urgency of the moment and possible actions. You'll be able to understand more comprehensively the new geopolitical and military disorders, their nuclear dimensions, and the forces that are driving them, and the new geopolitical and military disorders. And aside from that, you can help do what is imperative to stop the hands of that clock pushing ever closer to midnight. And just lastly, Joseph Gerson.
The one thing we didn't touch on as we close here, just to say, is one of the unique...
And we have about 30 seconds.
One of the unique aspects is we have two democracy, disarmament, and environmental leaders coming from Russia. It's quite a struggle to get their visas. And given the nature of U.S.-Russian relations, this is really a rare opportunity for people to hear what progressives in Russia are thinking about.
And the overall theme really is the urgency of the moment and possible actions. It's an exciting, comprehensive, imperative form. And you'll hear people like Joseph Gerson, who's worked so hard to put this together. And it's been our pleasure to speak with Joseph Gerson, American Friends Service Committee's disarmament coordinator. And I do, again, encourage you to get the book, the renowned book, Empire and the Bomb. We've got a lot of work to do. Joseph, thank you for being our guest.
Mimi, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's always great to talk to you.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Thank you so much for listening. Stop nuclear proliferation. It is our lives.
Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to play. Just give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comforting glow of a wood fire. But won't you take all your
has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.